Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to those who have just come this morning. You may or may not know that some of us have just sat through the whole night, and that this is our yearly Rohatsu retreat. Rohatsu is traditionally the kind of deepest, strongest session or intensive retreat of the year at a Zen temple. Now, we have our yearly session several weeks before this at Loon Lake. So this is kind of like, I don't know if it's the climax or the anticlimax, but we do this all day Saturday and Saturday night and Sunday morning. Rohatsu retreat. It's like doing the final day and a half of the session that we did three or four weeks ago. And it's traditional to sit through the night of the last night in a kind of reenactment or even re-embodiment of the Buddha's long night sitting under the Bodhi tree, according to the legend of the Buddha's enlightenment. So I don't think we sat quite as upright and unmoving as the Buddha did. There were some power naps along the way. But, you know, I don't think any of us would sat through the night, or even part of the night, as some did, without each other. We wouldn't have done it alone, like the Buddha did. I wouldn't have. There's something beautiful about sitting late at night or early in the morning, and it's very, very still. And for those of you who've never done it, we don't have any timing bells. We don't wear our robes. It's very low key. And we sit and walk just at our own rhythm. So someone will stand up and do some walking. Others are still sitting or standing. We can stand or we can lie down. We can use each of the four noble postures. And lying down meditation is a good thing to be able to do because, you know, there may come a time when that's the only way we can meditate. You know, if we're ill or injured or very, very old, it's good to be able to meditate lying down too, to deeply rest the body and keeping the mind awake. Not so easy, but it can be done, and it's a beautiful practice. So we got to do some of that last night. And yesterday, in Michael's Dharma talk, he told us the story of the Buddha's enlightenment. How after tremendous efforts, practicing with some of the major spiritual teachers of his day, and undergoing extreme ascetic practices, nearly starving, still not having reached the freedom he was seeking, he finally sat down beneath the Bodhi tree, the tree of awakening, and he vowed not to get up until he broke through to deep awakening. It's a heroic story, isn't it? The story of an extraordinary human being who became one of the world's greatest spiritual teachers. And he did sat, unlike us, he sat through the night unwavering, facing the demon hordes of Mara, the tempter, the demons of doubt, which we all have and face as we sit. And when the morning star appeared, he saw deeply into the true nature of existence. He realized the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, the 12-fold chain of causation, the basic teachings of the Buddha way. And then he set out on the long path, the long life of practice and teaching. He lived to his early 80s. And, like other heroes in the epics of many cultures, the Buddha still had challenges ahead, even after enlightenment. His jealous cousin tried to stir up dissension in the Sangha and even made an assassination attempt. Wars erupted between regional kingdoms. His own father's kingdom was ravaged by war that the Buddha tried to prevent and failed. So even today we try and fail to prevent wars. So even the Buddha had great challenges. And his old friend, Mara, the tempter. I love these stories. And I'm not going to go into detail this time, but I'm sure I will again, because I love these stories of Mara popping up throughout the Buddha's life. And later in life, it was almost like Mara was his old friend. Ah, yeah, there you are again. I see you. That same old doubt, or maybe a different twist on the same old doubt. Who do you think you are? Wouldn't you be able to do more good if you went into politics? Essentially, Mara showed up and asked Buddha that question at one point. Or, haven't you done enough already? Let the next generation take over. So even the Buddha had to face doubts through his long life. You know, he continued to live in the world of samsara, full of human suffering. And it couldn't have been easy all the time, even for a Buddha. How much more so for us, practicing as lay people 2.5 millennia later, in a world still fraught with suffering. Sickness, old age, and death are still very much with us. Despite the headlines that hold out the hope that medical technology is very close to vanquishing them. And the karmic consequences of human greed, hatred, and delusion are still painfully evident all around us. Sometimes I don't think I could manage to live in this world without the path of the Bodhisattva. The elaboration of the Buddha's teachings that emerged in new texts around the beginning of the Common Era, which came to be known as the Mahayana, the Great Wheel. I love the Bodhisattva way because it allows for the slow, steady courage of ordinary people. Ordinary people learning to pay attention to our lives just as they are, in each moment, opening to wisdom and compassion, with small and great awakenings along the way. The Bodhisattva realizes that right here in the midst of samsara, the world of suffering, the Bodhisattva realizes that this is not my life. And because this life is boundless, just because this life is boundless and not my life, it matters. Everything we do or say or don't say flows onward and outward without limit for the benefit or detriment of all beings. So we matter. And Zen, the Mahayana school that developed in China with meditation as its foundational practice, emphasizes the non-duality of samsara, the world of suffering, and nirvana, the absence of suffering, the freedom from suffering, freedom from obstruction. Not separated by vast space and time, right here. An awakening manifesting right here, in this moment, in this world. Like a lotus blooming its roots in muddy water, like we chant in our meal chant every day. May we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. And many of the koans, those ancient teaching dialogues and stories of Zen, nudge us to waken up to this reality of the non-duality of nirvana and samsara. So I am going to share a koan about enlightenment. Or rather, more accurately, non-attainment of enlightenment. And this koan is from the Gateless Barrier Collection, which from 13th century China, which we spent an 8-week practice period exploring quite recently. And I just can't seem to stop, so I'm going to give you one more. Here it is. Here's the story. A monk asked the priest Qingzhang of Xinyang, "The Buddha of supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom." How's that for a name? "The Buddha of supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom did zazen on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas, but the Dharma of the Buddha did not manifest itself, and he could not attain Buddhahood. Why was this?" Qingzhang said, "Your question is exactly to the point." The monk, who might have been a little frustrated with that answer, said, "But he did zazen on the Bodhi seat. Why couldn't he attain Buddhahood?" Qingzhang said, "Because he is a non-attained Buddha." Okay, that's the story. And like many koans, it needs a bit of unpacking to help us access. Usually when a Zen teacher talks about a koan, the first thing they do is give the pedigree of the Zen master in the koan, who was the disciple of so-and-so, who was the disciple of so-and-so, who was the disciple of so-and-so. But I'm going to skip over that part, because you wouldn't remember those names anyway. Okay. What is helpful to know for this koan is who the Buddha of supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom is. He is a mythic Buddha who appears in Chapter 7 of the Lotus Sutra. And some of you may remember this story because we studied the Lotus Sutra for the 2015 practice period a few years ago. In Chapter 7, the Buddha, the historical Buddha, tells the story of a deeply devout king who lived an immeasurably long time ago, who sat zazen on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas and did not attain enlightenment. So the Bodhi seat is a translation of the Sanskrit Bodhimanda, which refers to the place beneath the Bodhi tree where the Buddha was enlightened. According to Robert Aiken Roshi, the great American Zen teacher who wrote a wonderful commentary on these koans, this word Bodhimanda, as it moved through China and on into Japan, came to refer more widely to a place of practice and was translated as with the two characters way place, which in Japanese is dojo, and it's used mostly for martial arts practice halls now, although there are some Zen lineages that would refer to the Zendo as a dojo. So this is our practice place. This is our Bodhi seat. Your place that you sit in front of your little home altar at home is your Bodhi seat. The people who may be listening to this talk on the podcast days from now, it's quite possible some of them were sitting with us last night on their Bodhi seats at home, because they knew we would be sitting here at the Zendo. So So that's the Bodhi seat. Now, many of you know what a kalpa is, but some of you may not. Raise your hand if you don't know the word kalpa. Yeah. Okay. So a kalpa is a Sanskrit word for the lifetime of a universe. The ancient Indians just loved numbers and ways of calculating in unimaginably long periods of time and space. So there are various definitions of this, of a kalpa, and there are minor, medium, and major kalpas. But the description I like best asks us to imagine an immense mountain, 60 miles high and 60 miles wide. And a kalpa is the length of time it would take for the mountain to be completely worn down if a heavenly being flew over it once every 100 years and brushed it with the sleeve of her silken robe. That's how long a kalpa is. So I don't know if the idea of this king sitting for 10 kalpas and not attaining Buddhahood should be comforting or discouraging to us. It was hard enough for us to sit through last night. But the point of this koan is to nudge us out of the mistaken belief that enlightenment is something that we can get or keep. Even though the wording to attain enlightenment is used all the time in Buddhist texts, so our error is common and understandable. Who among us has not at some point felt or asked our teachers, "I've been practicing for, fill in the blank, 6 months, a year, 10 years, 30 years, for that matter. And I've only had the slightest glimpse of what might have been enlightenment. I've tried so hard, I've gone to as many sesshins as I possibly could." And from that question, you know, why am I not making progress? There are several directions we can go. One is, there just must be something wrong with me. I'm hopeless. This mind, right? Or, obviously this teacher isn't perfectly enlightened, so no wonder I'm not getting anywhere. Or, Sangha, these people are really messed up. I think I'll go home and Google up an enlightenment app. So maybe that's how the monk felt when he brought this question to his teacher of, why didn't this king get enlightened after 10 kalpas sitting on the Bodhi seat? And clearly he wasn't very satisfied with the teacher's answer. Your question is exactly to the point. He didn't get the point. So he asked again. And his teacher said, because he is a non-attained Buddha. So this only gives us doesn't really give us the whole story of this Lotus Sutra King. It's pretty long, but he sat for 10 kalpas without attaining Buddhahood. And then with the help of a whole array of various gods and heavenly beings, he sat for another 10 kalpas and was fully awakened. And he awakened just like the historical Buddha to the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, etc. And taught them, and then passed into a deep meditative state for another immensely unimaginably long period of time, leaving his 16 sons, who at that point had become novice monks, but not fully empowered, leaving these sons to go out and preach the Dharma, because he was, you know, in this deeply meditative state for a very long time. And the youngest of those sons, according to this mythic story, became Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha. The message of this story and of the Lotus Sutras itself, as we discovered when we were studying it a few years ago, is an egalitarian message that the Buddha Dharma is accessible to all, not just to monks and nuns and kings and Buddhas, but that all of us can practice and realize the deep truths of existence and walk the path of the Bodhisattva, awakening for and with all beings. The Lotus Sutra, despite its very florid style, which some of you may remember, and it is very different from the style of Zen koans, but it's a link, it's a key link to the non-dual teachings of Zen. Because it poses awakening as right here in this moment, not in the far distance. Even though he said sat for 10 long kalpas, but ordinary people are practicing in the Lotus Sutra in a way that's different from earlier texts. But in this koan, the Chinese Zen masters take the story a little further. The great Chinese Rinzai master, Linchi or Rinzai, explains the name of the Buddha in the story. He says, "Supremely pervading refers to the one who penetrates everywhere into the 10,000 things which have no nature or form." So seeing into the vast diversity of beings that have no fixed nature or fixed form. Surpassing wisdom refers to the one who has no doubts anywhere and does not attain a single thing. Meaning, does not cling to a single thing. Buddha is the one whose clear light shines throughout the Dharma world. So those are the elements of this Buddha's name. So we can begin to see that Buddha was an unattained Buddha because he realized there is nothing to attain. That the clear light of his awareness was unobstructed and saw what Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese Zen teacher, called the interbeing. He coined that word interbeing of all phenomena, the 10,000 things. You could already see that. Rinzai goes on and explains phrase by phrase in the koan. Sat on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas refers to the practice of the 10 paramitas, he says. So the paramitas are, and sometimes there are only 8 of them listed, they're characteristics of a bodhisattva that we cultivate on the bodhisattva path. Generosity, patience, morality, determination, energy, meditation, wisdom, skillful means, strength, spiritual knowledge. We could spend a lot of time just practicing with those, a lifetime. Lifetimes. But what he's pointing out is that the Buddha way is not just sitting on your zafu day and night, but of actualizing your practice in every aspect of your life, of cultivating those qualities with your entire being, body, heart, and mind. Maybe that was the king's mistake, that he thought, if I just sit zazen, I'll get it. Rinzai's point, of course, is also that there is no end point to attain. Only manifesting the reality of Buddha nature right now. So when he says, the koan says he did not attain Buddhahood, Rinzai says it means that a Buddha cannot become Buddha again because he's already a Buddha. So it wasn't a matter of attainment. the commentary of Wu Men, who compiled the collection in which this koan appears, expresses the central paradox of Zen, right? We live simultaneously in the truth of the everyday world of duality, of right and wrong, and birth and death, light and dark, nirvana and samsara. And at the very same time, from the perspective of the absolute, we live in a boundless web of dynamic interconnection, where all those dualities dissolve in a continuous flux of change. So the commentary, Wu Men's commentary, says, "I approve the old barbarian's realization, but I don't approve his understanding." So the old barbarian is, of course, Bodhidharma, who brought Zen practice from India to China, and he epitomizes Zen realization. So when Wu Men says realization here, he refers to the direct experience of Buddha nature. And when he says understanding, "I approve the old barbarian's realization, but I don't approve his understanding." Understanding here means our conventional way of grasping knowledge in our everyday lives. Then he goes on to say, "If an ordinary person realizes, he or she is thus a sage. If a sage understands, he or she is thus an ordinary person." So what he means is, if an ordinary person like you or me lets the obstacles drop away to a clear present awareness, even for a short time, then we're a sage. Our Buddha nature manifests. And if a sage enters into this discriminating mind of everyday life, then they're an ordinary person. Now this can be taken two ways. It can be taken, even a sage can slip into habit patterns of grasping and aversion. It only takes a split second, right, to slip. But it can also mean that a sage can function in the relative everyday world as a bodhisattva, using skillful means and wisdom and compassion and infinite patience to move through and in the world of suffering. So we're all both sage and ordinary person, right? Deluded lots of the time, yes, but also in any moment of full presence and awareness, we are free from hindrance. And so we practice to be stable and flexible, to be steady in our aspiration, and nimble in our recovery when we stumble, because of course we will stumble. And sometimes obstructions drop away. Sometimes after we've tried really, really, really hard and we finally give up. Or sometimes completely unasked for. This little section about sages and ordinary people reminds me of a passage from Dogen's Gendra Koan, Dogen being the Zen master who brought our style of practice from China to Japan. And he writes, "Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings." So he's saying that Buddhas clearly see clearly and deeply into the roots of delusion. They're greatly awakened about delusion. And ordinary beings have deluded ideas about enlightenment. So he loves to flip things upside down. Further, he says, there are those who continue realizing beyond realization and those who are in delusion throughout delusion. So he's saying there is no end to realization and there's no end to delusion. When Buddhas are, I like this line, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. However, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddhas. So in those moments when we are free from obstruction, we're not patting ourselves on the back saying, oh, wow, you got it. Because as soon as we do that, we don't, right? Buddhas aren't necessarily noticing even pain, that they're Buddhas, right? But they actualize the practice. Actualizing practice and realization are all one in Dogen's teaching. And through that actualization, through that living, we do our bodhisattva work in the world. So there's always a verse to go with these koans. So here's the verse, Wu Men's verse, which goes, better than knowing the body is knowing the mind in peace. When the mind is realized, the body is no longer anxious. When body and mind are fully realized, the saintly hermit declines to become a noble. Or in another translation, the hermit does not want to become a governor of state. So that first, the first couple of lines sound a little bit misleading because it seems to be setting up a comparison between body. Better than knowing the body is knowing the mind in peace. But all the commentaries seem to agree that actually our practice is to bring awareness to the totality of our experience, body, mind, and heart, with no separation. So that this translation of body here is really referring to our preoccupation with the stuff of our lives, you know, the material stuff of our lives, what we don't have and want, what we don't want. And when the whole body, heart, mind is at ease, then we aren't anxious. As the Heart Sutra says, without hindrance, there is no fear. Or as Hakuin Zenji says in his Song of Zazen, this very land is the pure lotus land, this very body, the Buddha. One of the commentators on this koan tells a delightful anecdote about an old Japanese hermit who declined to become a noble. His name was Tosui, and he lived in a hut and begged for alms. He didn't really want to become an abbot of a great temple. And one day, a devout follower of the Pure Land Buddhist sect stopped by his hut. So the Pure Land Buddhist sect is a little different from Zen. The emphasis in Pure Land Buddhism is devotion and chanting, a devotional practice, chanting the name of Amida Buddha, who's the Buddha of the Pure Land, the Western Pure Land, where one aims to be reborn after death, and from which it's a lot easier to get enlightened than here in this land of samsara. So it's a devotional practice in that towards Amida Buddha. So this devotee came to see Tosui and saw that he didn't even have an image of the Buddha anywhere in his little hut. And so he left and came back later with a picture of Amida Buddha. And he had probably a scroll, I'm guessing, a scroll. He hung it on the wall. And he told Tosui that he should worship this image every morning and evening and recite the name of Amida Buddha. And immediately Tosui took out his brush and ink and he wrote a verse on the image of Amida Buddha, which goes, "Though my hut is very small, I will let you stay here, O Amitabha. But please don't get the impression that I want you to assure my rebirth in the Pure Land." So I hope Shakyamuni Buddha up there on our altar will understand that we have valiantly sat through the night in reenactment of his long night under the Bodhi tree that is both symbolic and embodied, you know, in our actual practice. And in a few minutes, we'll chant in celebration and in gratitude for his deep awakening and great teaching. And we'll come back next week and sit again on our Bodhi seats. And we'll sit on our Bodhi seats at home. We'll go about in our daily lives and walk the Bodhisattva path guided by our vows. And this will be the heroism of the ordinary in a culture that worships celebrities and superheroes. So we know we don't have to become governors of state or superheroes. And I think that's what the world needs of us, of everyone, more ordinary heroes and much more than superheroes. So whether the king sitting in Zazen for 10 long kalpas, or ourselves sitting for hours overnight in the Zendo that may feel like kalpas. When hindrances drop away, like the husk of a cicada or the outgrown skin of a snake, we too are unattained Buddhas and decline to become a noble. So let us go on together. To the end of this year and into the next one, courageously practicing in our ordinary Bodhi seats. Thank you for sitting this weekend with us, and thank you for listening.
May our intention equally extend to every